Welcome to the Soho Forum. Our debate resolution for this evening reads, President Nayib Bukele's crime-fighting policies in El Salvador provide a model for reducing violence in other Latin American countries. Here, speaking for the affirmative, Peter Kiedel. Peter, please come to the stage. Speaking for the negative, Richard Avilar. Richard, please come to the stage. Peter, you have 15 minutes to make the case. Take it away, Peter. You can come to the podium.
Good evening. I want to thank the Soho Forum and Gene Epstein for inviting me here this evening. It's both a privilege and a pleasure to stand before you and discuss a topic of immense gravity, one that directly affects the lives, liberties, and futures of millions of human beings, the policies of President Bukele in El Salvador, and the broader implications of his approach for Latin America as a whole. I'm not a regional geopolitical expert, and I don't hold PhDs in theory. I'm a humble magazine journalist who spent a week in the beautiful country of El Salvador. I hope you indulge me by not laughing, but I'm still perhaps naive enough to believe that journalists have a responsibility to tell the truth. And the truth is, I witnessed a miracle where a country has cast off its chains of chaos, murder, and despair, and taken the destiny of a nation back into the hands of its citizens. The approach was as simple as it was effective. Lock up the gangs terrorizing the country. I believe President Bukele's approach is not only justifiable, it is essential. And further, I would argue that the lessons of his governance have profound implications for the entirety of Latin America, a region that for too long has been held hostage by violence, corruption, and criminality. Latin America, for all its cultural riches, natural beauty, and unbounded potential, is home to 8% of the global population, yet accounts for 37% of the world's homicides. In El Salvador, the situation reached an endemic level of chaos, culminating in the murder rate reaching an appalling 103 per 100,000 citizens in 2015, the highest in the world at that time. To compare, the murder rate in the United States of the same year was 4.9 per 100,000. For decades, Salvadorans lived in terror, not of some distant geopolitical threat or authoritarian regime, but of their own streets. Gang warfare, fueled by MS-13 and Barrio 18, was not merely a matter of turf disputes. It was an existential crisis. Extortion, kidnapping, rape, murder, and the conscription of children into criminal enterprises became the currency of daily life. It was, in every meaningful sense, a war zone. I will try to avoid discussing the lurid details, but you should research them if you have the stomach for such horrors. These weren't just drive-by shootings or some scene from a Hollywood gangster movie. This was torture carried out with machetes, the murder of children, and the wholesale tactic of the rape of women and little girls used as a weapon of terror. Enter then Nayib Bukele. Bukele's policies have been both bold and necessary. To dismiss them as populist overreach or illiberal excess is not merely wrongheaded, but morally indefensible. For when a government's primary duty is to protect its citizens, failure to act in the face of anarchy is itself an act of cruelty. Critics have lamented the suspension of some constitutional rights, the overcrowding of prisons, and the potential for abuses. I do not dismiss the concerns lightly. Any policy that centralizes power and curtails some liberties must be scrutinized rigorously. But let me pose a simple question. What is the alternative? To allow MS-13 to continue its reign of terror? To resign entire communities to the status of hostages, bound by the fear of death for stepping outside the door? Bukele has not only declared war on crime, he has declared war on the fatalism that had paralyzed his nation for decades. There's a quote erroneously attributed to Churchill that goes, "We sleep safe in our beds because rough men stand ready in the night to visit violence on those who would harm us." Bukele's policies are not perfect, but they are necessary. The results, ladies and gentlemen, speak for themselves. To his supporters, and I count myself among them, he is a pragmatist, a man who recognizes that the first duty of any government is to protect its citizens. In it is his 2022 declaration of a state of exception that has drawn the most attention. Under this policy, Bukele's government detained over 72,000 suspected gang members, dramatically reducing the ability of these organizations to operate. And what of the results? Here, even the most cynically inclined observer cannot deny the facts. According to foreignpolicy.com, in 2023, the country's reported homicide rate plunged to just 2.4 people per 100,000, slightly more than Canada. It is the lowest homicide rate for the country in over 30 years, down from that horrific peak of 103 just 8 years earlier. That is an extraordinary 97% reduction in homicides. Let me repeat that, a 97% reduction. Kidnappings, extortion, and other forms of violent crime have similarly plummeted. Entire neighborhoods that were once no-go zones are now reclaiming a semblance of normalcy. Families can walk the streets without fear, businesses can operate without paying murderous extortion, and children can imagine futures not bound by gang recruitment or premature death. Additionally, this reduction in violence has created ripple effects throughout society. Businesses are thriving as extortion rackets are dismantled. Tourism, once considered an unthinkable prospect in a country synonymous with danger, has surged. In 2024, compared to 2019, El Salvador saw a staggering 40% increase in tourist arrivals, boosting the economy and providing a desperately needed lifeline to its citizens. This is not merely anecdotal success. It represents a seismic shift, demonstrating what many of us have always known, that crime is not an unchangeable force of nature, but a challenge that can be confronted and overcome with the right combination of determination and strategy. To those who accuse Bukele of authoritarianism, I offer this rebuttal. Liberty without security is a cruel joke. What does it mean to have the right to free speech if you're too afraid to leave your home? What does it mean to have the right to vote if gang members dictate the outcome of elections? The rule of law is the bedrock of a free society, and Bukele's policies are restoring that rule to a nation that had all but lost it. This is not to say that we should ignore the risks of concentrated power. Bukele's actions must be monitored and government held accountable. But let us not fall into the trap of equating strength with tyranny or mistaking inaction for virtue. It's worth turning back to the Greeks and what Aristotle said about the rule of law in his book, Politics. For man, when perfected, is the best of animals, but when separated from law and justice, he is the worst of all. Since armed injustice is the more dangerous, and he is equipped at birth with arms, meant to be used by intelligence and virtue, which he may use for the worst ends. Wherefore, if we have not virtue, he is the most unholy and most savage of animals, and the most full of lust and gluttony. But justice is the bond of men and states, for the administration of justice, which is the determination of what is just, is the principal order of political society. Freedom without security is no freedom at all. A society in which law-abiding citizens live in perpetual fear of criminals is not a society that values liberty. It is one that has abandoned it altogether. As John Stuart Mill once wrote, a person may cause evil to others not only by his actions, but his inactions. The inactions of the previous government is the far greater crime. To those who argue that Bukele's policies are unsustainable, I say this. The unsustainable status quo was what preceded him. To those who claim that his measures are overly harsh, I say this. Harshness is not an inherent vice when directed at those who have made brutality their trade. And to those who fear that his methods might embolden autocrats elsewhere, I say this. Fear of hypothetical misuses of power is no excuse for failing to confront actual abuses of power by criminal organizations. The implication of Bukele's success extends far beyond El Salvador. Consider for a moment the larger landscape of South America. Countries like Brazil, Colombia, and Venezuela grapple with similarly pervasive issues of violence, organized crime, and state corruption. In Brazil, the homicide rate is approximately 23 per 100,000. Colombia, while improved from its narco state days, still experiences a homicide rate of 26 per 100,000. Venezuela, on the other hand, is a category of its own, plagued by both state-sponsored and criminal violence. It remains one of the most dangerous countries on earth. The lesson to be learned from Bukele's approach is not that repression is the answer, but that decisive action is indispensable. The criminal networks that plague this region thrive on the weakness of institutions. They exploit legal loopholes, bribe officials, and operate with near impunity. Incremental reforms, while important, are inadequate when the enemy operates with the ruthlessness of a cartel or a terrorist gang. Bold measures are necessary not as a permanent state of governance, but as a means of resetting the balance of power in favor of the law-abiding majority. Let us also consider the economic ramifications. Crime is not merely a moral failure, it's an economic catastrophe. The World Bank estimates that violence costs Latin America roughly 3% of its GDP annually. In El Salvador, that figure was closer to 5%. Reducing crime is not just a matter of saving lives, it's a matter of unlocking economic potential. Businesses that once fled the region are beginning to return. Moreover, the social fabric of a nation cannot be mended in an environment of terror. Education, healthcare, and infrastructure development, all these vital aspects of human flourishing, require a baseline of security to thrive. Bukele's policies, by restoring order, create the conditions for broader societal progress. What Bukele's example demonstrates is that even in the face of seemingly insurmountable challenges, progress is possible. But it requires courage. Courage to confront entrenched interests, to challenge orthodoxy, and to prioritize the safety of the many over the comfort of the few. Latin America's governments must recognize that security is the foundation upon which all other freedoms rest. Without it, there can be no economic growth, no social progress, no justice. The stakes could not be higher. Latin America stands at a crossroads. The challenge before them is not merely one of policy, but of philosophy. Do we believe that human beings have the right to live free from fear? Or do we accept that violence is an inevitable part of life in this region? Do we prioritize the rights of criminals over the rights of their victims? Or do we have the courage to demand accountability? Do we wait for international organizations and think tanks to devise white papers and perfect solutions? Or do we act decisively with the tools at hand? Bukele's policies are not a panacea, nor are they without flaws. But they represent something more valuable than perfection. They represent hope. Hope that the cycle of violence can be broken. Hope that nations long dismissed as failed states can rise again. Hope that the people of Latin America can reclaim their streets, their economies, and their future. History will not remember those who stood by and wrung their hands as their nations burned. It will remember those who acted, took risks, and dared to confront the forces of chaos and disorder. That is the legacy Nayib Bukele is building in El Salvador. It is a legacy that Latin America, and indeed the world, would do well to emulate. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a cause worth defending. Thank you.
I take it this way, yeah. Ricardo, take it away. 15 minutes for the negative.
Let me just find the right place for my notes. All right, thank you so much. Thank you, Gene, for your kind invitation. Peter, it's a pleasure. El Salvador is indeed considerably less dangerous than it was many years ago. We cannot deny that. We cannot deny the drastic reduction in homicides, and gang prison now seems like a tale from the past in many communities. Now, by the sound of this, you may be thinking, this will be a really short debate, but there's much more to say. And reality is far more nuanced. And actually, I wish I lived in that country you were describing. I'm here to argue that El Salvador's security model in El Salvador is not a desirable or even transferable model for any other Latin American country. And to do that, I will use 4 points, okay? I'm going to explain how Salvadoran institutions work. I'm going to explain how the security policy that we're going to talk about has been devised, how it was implemented, and where it's leading the country. Before I say that, I completely agree with you. Like, the absence of fear is much more important than the mere absence of conflict for a society to be considered peaceful or safe. A recent poll by one of the leading universities in El Salvador, one that Nayib Bukele has repeatedly quoted when it shows his popularity ratings, showed something that may seem strange to you. Over 60% of the people are afraid of voicing their opinions in El Salvador. And over 80% of the people believe that there may be consequences for expressing criticism of the government. In sum, Salvadorans apparently still live in some kind of fear and have done so for a long time. From fear of the military in the 70s and 80s, they moved on to fear of gangs. And now they have moved on to fear of the government. What I will try to argue today is that El Salvador may be less dangerous, but it is not safer. Unless we understand safety as the silent act to comply without questioning. And in a room with liberty-minded individuals, I don't think we are. Now, point number one, Salvadoran institutions. Nayib Bukele rose to power in 2019 with an anti-elite and anti-corruption discourse. And a country fed up with both believed in him. Shortly after, he demonstrated that he's less interested in the courtesies of democracy and the rule of law and more open to a perceived sense of effectiveness. And so some results have been visible. He promised and he seemed to deliver without minding those boring processes of institutions and the rule of law. And it's effectively leading the country into believing that there must be faster ways to achieve what we want to achieve. But in February 2020, something happened. In the middle of a showdown between the government and Congress, that was at the time led by the opposition, Nayib Bukele stormed our National Assembly, or Congress, with heavily armed police officers and soldiers. Now, I believe to some of you, the eloquence of good words and nice debates is a good tool, where to Bukele, I think his eloquence lies somewhere else. He sat down on the speaker's chair and said, and I quote, "It is clear who is in control now." A year later, when he gained a legislative majority, he instructed his people in Congress to get rid of the Constitutional Court and the Attorney General, who was also investigating allegations of corruption in his government. The Supreme Court justices and the Attorney General were replaced by people loyal to Bukele's own party. And 2 months later, he got rid of a third of the country's judges who were replaced by, well, people loyal to Bukele's party. And so on. The Human Rights Office, the Electoral Board, the institution in charge of auditing his administration, they're all controlled by people loyal to him. This is the first point I want to make. El Salvador does not have any more checks and balances. If any other Latin American country wanted to follow his security model, step number one would be to get rid of restraints and give one person all power and hope that that one person is good. Point number two, how the security plan was devised. Now, you may have heard of Bukele's war on gangs and his tough on crime approach and how El Salvador's authorities have arrested almost 80,000 people, ridding the streets of criminal gangs. But this open war was not always Bukele's security model. His first approach was radically different, to broker deals with gang leaders so they would stop murdering people in exchange for benefits inside prisons, releasing prominent gang leaders, and facilitating gangs to operate some businesses. Now, this is not new in El Salvador. It has been done before. Many of Bukele's predecessors did it. Some of them are in prison for that. But the president who promised change ended up following the footsteps of those before him. And don't take my word for it, or that of any independent media outlets that have reported on this. Less than 3 miles away from here, I believe that is south, at the Eastern District Court, a man is being charged with transnational terrorism. His name is Elmer Canales Rivera, his alias is Crook. He's a prominent MS-13 gang leader who was arrested in Mexico in November 2023. In 2020, however, he was sentenced to a 40-year prison sentence in El Salvador. But in 2021, he walked out. And after a brief stay in a luxury apartment complex in San Salvador, he was taken to the Guatemalan border where he received a firearm, was introduced to a smuggler, and completed his escape. The person who drove him to the border was not a gang member. It was Carlos Marroquin, the head of Bukele's social threat unit, a member of his security circle. How do we know this? How do we know this for a fact? Because Carlos Marroquin himself told a gang leader in an audio that was leaked to the press that he did it to show the gang, to show MS-13 in particular, the government's loyalty and to gain their trust. I can happily share with you the link so you can hear his words. El Salvador's current security model, state of emergency, or what we call el régimen, was imposed on March 27, 2022, after gangs took the lives of 87 people in 3 days. The reason behind this massacre is that the government failed to comply with the terms of their pact. This was also explained by Marroquin in that call that we had access to, or like another media outlet had access to. El régimen, our security model, included the suspension of four fundamental rights: the privacy of communications, freedom of association, which has been reinstated, the right of legal defense upon being arrested, and an extension of the period between an arrest and someone's arraignment. It has been fortified with dozens of criminal justice reforms, such as toughening crime sentences related to gangs, extending the period in which you may be arrested without a trial, and empowering police officers. Police officers and soldiers have been given a green flag to conduct large-scale raids, they have received arrest quotas, and the government even approved prison sentences for journalists who reported on gangs and fear that this may cause despair, sorry. This has been eliminated, but the threat was constant for almost a year. From a policy perspective, this was an improvised measure once the first approach, negotiating with gangs, failed. A toughened crime approach that has not addressed the root causes of violence and has resorted to policing. A policy that depends on government-provided facts and figures. As independent organizations and media outlets do not receive any formal official information under a Freedom of Information Act. A policy that depends on one man and his whims. So, Gene, when you asked me about debating, or you asked me to debate about the security model, I for a second, I thought, which one? The one where he negotiates with gangs? Or the one in which he's tough on them? I assume it's the latter. Now, the third point. I've made the first two. The third point, what el régimen has meant, what the security program has meant. Salvadorans, as I said, no longer see gang leaders roaming their communities. That is a great thing. That is not small. But that doesn't mean they live entirely safe and free. Let me tell you a story. That of Atilio Montalvo, a 72-year-old man who was part of the guerrillas during our civil war from 1980 to 1992. After the 92 peace accords, he dedicated his life to teaching economics and advocating for the rule of law. On the 30th of April, 2024, he was arrested under terrorism charges. May I remind you, 72 years old. Nayib Bukele accused him and a few other war veterans who had denounced El Salvador's democratic backsliding of plotting a terrorist attack without showing any evidence. Due to El Régimen, Mr. Montalvo was not given immediate access to an attorney. His family has denounced this as a politically motivated arrest, and they have not been given information about his whereabouts or the state of his health, given that he's diabetic and has chronic hypertension. After weeks of demanding the liberation of his dad, his son, Atilio Jr., had to leave the country as he was being harassed, followed by unmarked cars, and threatened. He's now in Mexico. Almost a year later, his dad has still not faced trial but remains in prison. A 72-year-old ill man who was accused of terrorism. Now, during the state of exception, along with this man, Atilio Montalvo, there have been over 80,000 arrests. Bukele himself recently acknowledged that around 8,000 people have been released as they found no signs of gang affiliation. But independent reporting shows that over 30,000 people may have been arrested arbitrarily in El Salvador. A media outlet published police files that were leaked recently, showing that in some cases, the reason behind the arrest is that someone seemed nervous. Now, I don't know how often you get nervous. I'm often very nervous. I wouldn't like to be in prison for that. Some have been rounded up after anonymous calls. We also heard a credible report, of a taxi driver that was falsely accused by a competitor, and he was arrested and accused of illicit association. El Régimen, as we call the security program, has meant that young people in stigmatized working-class communities are increasingly prone to be arrested and accused of being associated with gangs. Police brutality is present, and those people terrorized by gangs are now terrorized, or those people who were once terrorized by gangs are now being terrorized by people in uniforms. Oh my God, 5 more minutes. Delivery drivers, construction workers, students, they have been taken to prison without any evidence. Thousands of mothers flock to prisons and the Human Rights Commission to ask where their children are being held or whether they're still alive, to no response. They often demonstrate that their kids have stable jobs, a university career, and even produce evidence to show that they have no prior convictions, to no avail. The threat of arbitrary arrest looms over Salvadorans who are choosing to live in silence. And the organization that advocates for the release of innocents arrested has been subject to threats of incarceration too. In this period, we have also learned that almost 350 people have died inside Nayib Bukele's prisons. Some others have died shortly after being released after months of medical neglect. Forensic analysis shows that in many cases, there have been signs of broken bones and punctured lungs. Many families have found out about the passing of their relatives, not because of an official call, but after a funeral home reached out to offer their services. In addition to that, people who have been released and have spoken to media outlets have denounced beatings, torture, lack of medical supplies, and that this violence is rarely targeted at actual gang members being locked up. Out of the thousands arrested, a significant percentage, over 90% of people, have been accused of illicit associations. Not murder, rape, extortion, kidnapping, just a generic blanket charge. In essence, El Salvador has shifted the presumption of innocence, which is a bedrock of our legal system, that you are innocent until proven guilty. In El Salvador, if you're arrested, you're presumed guilty until you demonstrate that you're not, or until your case gets so viral on social media that authorities have to let you go. But not everyone is so influential, or until you pass. El Salvador is haunted by old ghosts we thought were long gone. Torture, arbitrary incarceration, politically motivated arrests, and fear. Not of gangs, but of men and women in uniform. That concludes my third point, that this is a policy of mass incarceration, presumption of guilt, and violation of fundamental human rights. And lastly, my fourth point, what this means for the future. El régimen, as we call it, is an instrument of fear. In the last election, when the opposition denounced irregularities in the manual recount, members of Nayib Bukele's party threatened to apply El régimen to them. Worker unions and civil society leaders have been told that El régimen will also be applied if they continue protesting or raising their concerns. Street vendors have been evicted from informal shacks to clean up squares in the renovated San Salvador Historic City Center, and they have been told that if they voluntarily leave, El régimen will be applied to them. Young people with tattoos, men with long hair. We have reports that men have been arrested because they had long hair and the police officers threatened to cut his hair. And he's like, no, I don't want it. So they were taken. And youth from impoverished communities have been threatened by police officers and soldiers patrolling the streets. El régimen is no longer a security policy aimed at gangs. It is an instrument of social control. It is a policy to guarantee compliance and obedience by a man who has effectively controlled all power around himself. It is a cornerstone of Nayib Bukele's power grab, one that has rendered him the potential leader, not of a one-party state, but of a one-man state. El Salvador is less dangerous, we agree. But if you disagree, if you have questions, if you have relatives that have been unjustly incarcerated, if you have been evicted, if you do not comply, and if you have tattoos, if you live in an impoverished or a stigmatized community, it is not safer. And in the words of Milton Friedman, nothing is more permanent than a government temporary program. This regime of exception may be lifted, but the wide net of criminal reforms that constitute a presumption of guilt will linger. El Salvador has traded freedom for security, and we know how the story goes. As a country, we have given a man unrestrained and unchecked power. To believe he will not abuse of it, solely based on him not being a leftist, or him liking the same politicians that you do, or him liking Bitcoin, is a dangerous and naive experiment. Going back to the resolution on the table, Latin America has experienced the Bukele model before, and many times. It came in the form of grave human rights violations throughout the 20th century. The Nayib Bukele security policy is in fact a desirable model, but not for Latin American societies who wish to live safely. It is a desirable model for those who utilize fear as a tool to exert control. It is a highly desirable model for aspiring autocrats. Thank you.
Five minutes for rebuttal. Peter, you want to take you want to sit here or you want to take the part?
Your choice. Sit here, that's fine. Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think you made a lot of great points, Ricardo, and you raised some, you know, genuine concerns about the people there and the dangers of autocracy and authoritarianism. And, you know, I don't dismiss any of those things. I think those are good questions that are worth discussing and to think about. I guess I would push back of, you know, you said it several times, well, it's safe, but, oh, it's so much safer, but. I mean, this is a sea change of safety. This isn't a slight reduction in crime. I mean, you give me an anecdote of some older man who shouldn't be in prison. I can give you the statistics. In 2015, there were over 6,200 people murdered in El Salvador. In 2024, there were 102. That's 6,100 lives that were not taken in horrific gang violence, torture, horror that unfortunately your country has experienced for years and years and years. And so to me, I don't think you can just hand wave that away and go, oh, well, you know, it's safer, but, you know, all these things. This was a country that was living in complete fear. And, you know, you can argue that there's less freedom. Now, I would argue that being able to take your children to the park and buy ice cream is something that counts in the on the ledger of liberty, and that walking around without being concerned about being kidnapped or murdered, starting a business. On the plane ride down, I spoke with this El Salvadoran grandmother who was going back down there, and she was telling me about some of the things that her family had experienced, and it was horrific. They extorted people down to the guy selling ice cream on the side of the road who had to give 35% of his money to the gangs, otherwise he would be murdered, and they would murder these people. So that person then can have a business and start, and that extortion went throughout the society, it seems like, at least from what I've read and what I've spoken with people. So you want to roll this back? Is it not good that these policies were instituted? Would you have rather gone back to 2015? And, I mean, to me, you have to, at the end of the day, you have to accept democracy. What does democracy mean? The people have voted for this leader. They have voted for these policies. These weren't secret policies that he sprung on them. This is what he said he was going to do. And I haven't heard you or anyone else contend that the election was stolen or that his support is fake and that it's not. I forget what Nuevas Ideas won by, but it was 80-90%, I believe. To me, at a certain point, you have to accept the reality of the democracy in the country and be okay with that. And if they felt that their country was in such extreme danger that it took these policies, if the crime rate goes up 2 points in the U.S., I don't think we need to start, following Bukele's model. But these people who live there, and this is, I talked to 60, 80 people when I was down there, cab drivers, waiters, all kinds of people. I was on my own. I wasn't with, some government handler. I don't see why they would lie to me. I've spoken to El Salvadorians in Colorado and Texas and, asked them because I was curious about what I had experienced, what I read down there. And they all say the same thing, even with slight quibbles about maybe how the policies are enacted, is that, their society was in the middle of a death spiral and that they needed law and order in order to be free and in order to pursue their liberty and their lives of their families. And to me, I'm not going to hand wave that away, and I'm not going to pretend that their democratic choice is wrong in exchange for some abstract, bureaucratic control that we go back to. I don't accept that.
What I don't want to accept is that the only way to do this, the only way to get rid of gangs, the only way to solve a security problem is by giving one person effective power and control over every single aspect of our political system. I refuse to believe that 30,000 people is a solid price, 30,000 people unjustly incarcerated is a good price to pay. One person would be dramatic. You can understand that in any society there will be cases of unjustly arrested people and arbitrary arrests or something. But 30,000, this is now pointing at something that's more systematic, something that's not anecdotal, something that is not just, a police officer having a bad day and arresting the wrong person. This is a policy of, and we have seen documents, we have seen reports of this. We had access to leaked police memos and stuff, and we saw that they had quotas of arresting, 500 people a day. And we saw them the very first few days of the, el régimen, as they called it, or as everyone calls it in El Salvador, we saw that. We saw them rounding up poor communities. We saw them going to stigmatized or impoverished neighborhoods and taking young people, taking anyone who had tattoos. And those people will sit on a jail cell for at least 2 years before they have even had the possibility to say, "What did I do wrong? I haven't done anything wrong." They had no access to legal defense. They were not read their charges. And in some cases, we have seen different information given by the courts or by the police whenever they tweet a case. So I think when you see a case of 30,000 people wrongly accused of this blanket charge, as I said, the charges, illicit associations, you start to think that this may be something other than just control, like just combating gangs. And yes, one thing, like two things can coexist at the same time. I believe that it is a less dangerous place. I do not believe it's a safe place, because safety is not just the absence of conflict. It's also feeling that you can voice your concerns, that you can have an opinion, that you can say, I do not like this government, or I don't think this government is right, and not living in fear of being harassed, or being threatened, or being spied, things that many Salvadorans, including myself, we have experienced. I believe it's a false dichotomy that we either have security under a one-man rule, or insecurity and chaos in the streets. Many other countries have done different things. I don't know what the alternative is, but I am not sitting on a government office. I'm not sitting in a government office enacting government plans. But I refuse to believe what was so horribly stated by Matt Gaetz in Time magazine recently, when he said, and I paraphrase, I don't remember the exact phrase, but sometimes a third world country needs third world solutions. I refuse to believe that my country, that has 6 million individuals, mind you, this is not a country, this is not a blob, this is not an idea, 6 million individuals, is willing to let 30,000 of them be arrested so that the beast of the state is happy and, you know, like gives us licenses. Because at the moment, I don't think we have rights. I don't think we have freedom. I don't think we have liberties. I think we have licenses. Licenses that can operate until you bother the government, Mr. Bukele, so much that he decides that you're next. In September 2021, on Independence Day, Nayib Bukele gave a speech saying that El Salvador had, El Salvador had accomplished 199 years of independence. And he said, back then, we fought an external enemy, Spain. And now we face an internal enemy. And I don't know if any of you is from Latin America or you have studied the history of Latin America, but whenever you hear those words, internal enemy, that is a massive red flag. Because that is pointing at someone who's willing to use the power of the state to go against citizens, not just on the grounds of being part of a criminal organization, but also on the grounds of disagreeing with his rule. Many of my colleagues, dear friends of mine, have had to leave the country with 2 hours' notice because fortunately they had a source who told them, you're next, you should pack up your bags and leave. Someone in this room has actually moved to the border to pick up one of a friend of ours who's a journalist. El Salvador is quickly becoming an autocracy. And I refuse to believe that that is the only way in which we are going to achieve safety or security. So I refuse to take that false dichotomy that it's either complete control over the lives of people, 60% living with fear, or the chaos that we used to have.
Thank you for that rebuttal. We now go to the Q&A portion of the evening, and I see the mic over there, so please line up and ask your questions as though it's a question. But before we do that, and any time during this Q&A period, you're free to ask each other a question. First, do either of you want to exercise that prerogative right now to ask each other a question, or do you want to wait for the audience questions? Anybody? All right.
Sure. Yeah.
You want to ask a question?
I mean, I'm just curious. You seem to sidestep the concept of that these policies and this person has been voted on by the people, and he won in an overwhelmingly process. And in a democratic process, at least to my knowledge, is not some sham election. How do you take that? I mean, do you subvert the will of the people? Do you overturn that? How do you square that?
I believe it was Alexis de Tocqueville in the 19th century that said that there's a difference between democracy and the tyranny of a majority. I do believe that El Salvador had free elections. I'm not sure how fair they were, but the result is overwhelming. He won with 84%, so even without some of the abuses that we saw, it would have been, like, he would have won the election. Mind you, this candidate was not allowed to run again. This is another important thing to consider. El Salvador's constitution prohibits explicitly, and still does, prohibits the like re-election in six different paragraphs, in six different articles. We have more than you. We have like 281 articles in our constitution. But out of those, seven of them explicitly say no one can run for re-election. And one even says there will be punishments, not for those who run for re-election, but for those who even advocate publicly for that. And this has to do with the long history of military governments and dictatorships that we had in the past. He removed the Supreme Court justices. They then made, like, came up with this ruling saying, well, wait, like, re-election is now valid. And so he ran. So, yeah, he won, and the majority of the people, he's a widely popular politician, and he's a widely popular person. In El Salvador, people voted for him, but I do not believe the popularity or, you know, 84%, even 94% or whatever percentage of a vote will allow some person to violate the Constitution and fundamental human rights. I believe in the end that a country is comprised of individuals, and if you're violating the fundamental rights of one individual to achieve some greater good, no matter how the result goes, no matter how it goes, but if you unjustly target one individual, then that is not a good thing. I do not agree with that. And I cited the case of Atilio Montalvo, a 72-year-old man, not just as an anecdote, but I could tell you many more cases that we have reported that have come to our offices and everything, but to showcase the absurdity of this, a person who openly criticized the government has now been accused of plotting a terrorism attack. That is absurd. So going back to Tocqueville, I do not believe that the fact that 84 out of 100 people applauding something makes it good. I also believe that people speak from their traumas, and El Salvador, being a scarred society, is obviously more prone to accept things that maybe in this forum, given the chance to have a nuanced conversation, we're like, well, it's probably not okay to incarcerate a lot of people just to show some strength in numbers. So I obviously, as I said earlier, I don't know what the alternative is because I'm not a policy creator. I'm just analyzing policies, and I'm gathering evidence in my journalistic job.
But you question the complete legitimacy of his of his having been elected, or you?
I question the legitimacy of his re-election. I believe he's a de facto president at the moment. Validated by 84% of the people, but under our rules, he is not a legitimate president. It's like as if President Trump decided to run before changing the amendment that prohibited it. Like, if he did that, he would not be a legitimate president. It's exactly what's happening in El Salvador.
Okay, yeah. All right, and we want to take it to audience questions. Difficult to see you, but please ask a question, like the question. Take it away. First question, please.
Yeah.
I'm not hiding, by the way. Here? I just can't see you.
Yeah. Is this better? Is this slightly better? Okay.
It's this light, so yeah.
Okay, great. All right. So you mentioned that, like, one of your arguments was that you refuse to accept that there's not a better way. I would just ask, what is that? Like, where have you seen Bukele's results without his tactics?
Where have you seen the question being that... Where have you seen Bukele's results without his tactics? Yes. I guess the question is directed at Ricardo. Go ahead.
Yes. Okay. 1 minute. Again, I'm not a policymaker. I'm not a policy creator or anything. I'm an analyst. Sorry. I don't think I have seen the speed of his results, but at the same time, I have seen like in Peru, for example, in the 90s with Shining Path. And Alberto Fujimori and all the power grab that led to the disbandment of this terrorist organization. What effectively happened after that is that he concentrated so much power that he started targeting the opposition, media outlets. So I have seen the Bukele story before, but your question is not that. Your question is, where have I seen the results without the cost? I don't think I've seen a policy that has so quickly achieved to disband a criminal organization, but I also haven't seen such a fast power grab. Like, whatever Hugo Chavez did in Venezuela in 10 years, Bukele did in 3 years. And that is something to consider. Something to consider, like, as we were talking about re-election, they all did it. Chavez did it in Venezuela, Correa did it in Ecuador, Evo Morales did it in Bolivia,
Daniel Ortega did it in Nicaragua. So I have not seen results so quickly, but I have also not seen such a fast power grab that effectively gives one person all of power.
Do you have a comment, Peter, to make to that question or answer? Any comment?
I mean, I think it's just, I mean, you're advocating basically to an imaginary, a reversion to an imaginary solution. And, you know, at the end of the day, going from 6,200 murders to 100 murders a year is the net effect of what these policies that the people of El Salvador have democratically chosen and elected on. And I don't, to me, arguing about counterfactuals or hypotheticals are, you know, they pale in comparison to what the facts on the ground are.
But wait, Gene, sorry, for a second. I am not advocating, I haven't advocated for any particular model. I am advocating for the price of safety not being an arbitrary rule in a one-person state. That is what I'm advocating for. If you want to talk policy, we can talk about actually cleaning the prosecutor's office from those corrupt, like or the attorney general's office from those corrupt prosecutors. Because in El Salvador, at the same time, we have had allegations of corruption inside of the government that stopped being prosecuted once he replaced the attorney general. So if we want to talk about the rule of law, we should talk about the rule of law for everyone, not just for people in the streets and the critics of the government. I am not advocating for, as I said, I haven't voiced my support for any one model. What I am saying is I do not support this model because it means El Salvador falling back into autocracy, as we have seen before.
Next question.
So first, I want to get a clarification. The 30,000 people you mentioned, they were arrested. They're also still in prison.
A lot of them have been. Bukele recently admitted that 8,000 people have already been freed, but it is an estimate of several organizations that have done a tremendous work of following every case, following up with prisons, following up with government officials. So they have estimated that up to 30,000 people could have been unjustly arrested. At least 8,000 confirmed by the government, but up to 30,000.
Unjustly arrested and then imprisoned.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, in El Salvador, remember, you can be in prison for up to 2 years before you face trial and can be acquitted. And also, justice, this is important to say, judges that whenever they arraign someone, like after 2 weeks of the arrest, judges that were releasing people have been removed and have been transferred to smaller or more remote courts in the country. So there is a pressure for judges in El Salvador to maintain people arrested and detained.
Question? Any particular question? Or just
And so what would be a proportion of innocent people in prison that either of you would find acceptable? I mean, you seem to think it's just sort of fine. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, and you seem to think it's totally unacceptable. And what would be a proportion that both of you would find tolerable?
I mean, I don't think anyone who's innocent should be in prison. I mean, the 30,000 number is definitely in dispute over just, you keep saying as if it's 100% sure that there's 30,000 innocent people in prison. I don't think that there's overwhelming evidence that that actually is true. And, I mean, the evidence that you've just said as well is that 8,000 of these people were wrongfully swept up in these arrests, and they were released. And so, I mean, it seems like there are mechanisms for releasing people that were accidentally arrested and swept up in these raids, and that even by your own estimation, they've released a third of those people. So, I mean, the idea that they're just arbitrarily keeping people that they know are innocent, I don't think is borne out by the facts.
Next question.
Hi. Thank you so much for sharing, both of you. I have a question for each of you, if you don't mind, for Ricardo. Every president that has gone into, has to be a president.
Really, we generally have a rule that only one question. So please choose your best question. And both of them are going to answer it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Most presidents that have gone into El Salvador have done so under the promise to be able to reduce violence, given that El Salvador has had an issue with gang violence for so long. You mentioned one of the big issues that has occurred under Bukele has been that he has removed many of the parts of the judicial system and other parts of the government that have impeded this progress. Given the failure of presidents for decades to be able to curb violence in El Salvador, would you not say that doing this allowed him to be able to reduce the violence and perhaps rooted out the corruption, which has been very much believed and endemic within the Salvadorian government?
Sounds like the question is mainly addressed to Ricardo. So,
short answer is no. More nuanced answer is if you see the homicide rate over the last 10 years, of course, 2015 was the murder capital of the world. There were 911 murders in August 2015, so it's a horrible year for Salvadorans. But over the last few years of the last president before Nayib Bukele, we started seeing a very slow decline. Not obviously not as steep as what we have seen now. And then obviously in the first years of Bukele before the state of exception, we also saw a steep decline, but we know it's because of those negotiations with gangs. Now, I do not believe that what has effectively happened in El Salvador is that they got rid of those corrupt parts inside the judicial system. I believe they have gotten rid of a third of the judges in El Salvador, and that includes corrupt judges, but it also includes fairly, you know, more valuable members of the judicial community in El Salvador. What they did was to get rid of the attorney general that was investigating corruption inside Bukele's ranks, and some of the judges that were actually taking the time to hear some cases and actually release people that had been, you know, swept up, they were also removed. They were also sent to, like, less important tribunals or courts inside the country. So I think it's a misrepresentation of what he has done. What he has done is to fill government institutions with people loyal to him. Now, this obviously has meant that it's an expedited process for when they actually arrest gang members, but it's also an expedited process for when they arrest people who are innocent. But it also means that further down the road, if Nayib Bukele keeps concentrating power, there are no guarantees for any Salvadoran citizen that they may not be arbitrarily arrested. You know, like, we cannot assume that when someone concentrates power, they will only use it for a good cause. That has been very naive in the past, and it is still very naive in the present. So I don't think he has gotten rid of, like, because if we were to talk about how to reduce violence in a more, in a healthier way, I would say, yes, you have to get rid of the corrupt judges. You have to get rid of corrupt prosecutors. You have to get rid of corrupt police officers. But that is not what has happened in El Salvador. They just got rid of people in order to replace them with people who are more who are friendlier to Bukele's interests in his party.
Comment from you.
And I don't. Please excuse me. I don't want to put any words in your mouth, Ricardo. And I, but like you made two interesting points in your discussion, where, you know, in a lot, some of what you're saying hinges on the concern that this is going to turn into authoritarian autocrat, like we've seen in other places in Latin America, and that he's going to keep consolidating this power and take power. But from your own presentation, haven't there been two very important aspects of this emergency control that he's rolled back and given back rights to the people? So isn't it fair to say, at least in those cases, he's not garnering more power, he's actually garnering less and establishing more freedom?
There were two things. Yes, I effectively said that there have been two things that were regained. One was this reform that allowed for up to 15-year prison sentences for journalists who covered gangs. The mere fact that this was introduced is worrying, and obviously we're very happy that was taken off. I don't think they need it. I think they can lock anyone up whenever they can, and it's a threat. You know, we have received threats. Many of our colleagues have had to leave the country, as I said. So yes, they scaled it back. I believe it was a negotiation with the Biden administration at the time. El Salvador was negotiating a deal with the IMF, which they got in December 2024. And I believe the Biden administration gave up when they first came. The Biden administration said, we're going to try to put a stop to the like all these abuses. There were sanctions against government officials in El Salvador, constant reminders that some of the ways that Bukele was using were part of the autocrats' playbook. So I believe it's part of, because when El Salvador first got like a pat in the back to sit from the Biden administration to get the IMF funds, it's exactly the same week that they rolled back on this policy. But those were two measures out of a sea of reforms that effectively changed the presumption of innocence into presumption of guilt. So they were two small changes in a sea of reforms that no longer guarantee that you will follow due process of law.
Next question.
Yeah, I mean, Peter, my question is to Peter. Even to what you just said, he chose to give back these powers. He chose to roll it back. Isn't the idea of checks and balances and institutions that a president can't just choose to take power when he wants and give it back when he wants? Even if you like Bukele, which I don't trust him, but I guess you do, even if you think he's a benevolent dictator, what do you think about the long term, in 10 years or 20 years, without strong institutional checks on someone's power? Who comes next? Do you worry about the long-term impact of destroying institutions and checks on power?
Well, I don't think that he's a benevolent dictator. I think that he's a duly elected head of state that won with an overwhelming majority. Again, I think that, yeah, I mean, I'm a journalist who went down there, and I'm not an expert in the history of everything that's happened in El Salvador and every, the entire history of the entire region. I'm not an expert. I went down there, and actually my piece is very, there actually isn't a lot on the crime part of it. It was really more on the beauty of the place and like capturing a moment where there's an excitement about getting rid of this horror and terror has allowed people, common people to live freely and start their business and live safely. And also new businesses from, crypto and investment that are flocking down there because there is an explosion of liberty happening. So, yeah, I mean, if you're asking me in 20 years if he turns into a horrible dictator, yeah, that would be awful. I hope that that doesn't happen, and I would not support that. But all I can go on is what I've seen now, and it seems like, being able to go outside your house and be able to start a business without getting murdered is an advancement of liberty.
Can I go? Of course, yes.
Yeah. Thank you. I do not believe that winning an election is the only thing that would prevent you from being considered a dictator. I believe that's a very simplistic way of seeing, like, I don't think that, like, democracy is a switch. Like, did he win an election? Yes or no? I mean, Nicolas Maduro won an election recently. Of course, it was a farce. Of course, it was a sham. Saddam Hussein won an election with like 99.6% of the vote. So, I'm not saying
these weren't sham elections.
I'm not disputing that. I'm saying Nayib Bukele is very popular, but I don't believe popularity is the only reason for legitimacy in a country. And we have a saying in Latin America. I don't know if you have it in English, but if it waddles like a dog and quacks like a dog and walks like a dog, it is a dog. When you see Nayib Bukele and you see what he's doing, removing all checks on his power, removing all restraints, it's if you compare it to the playbook of every other autocrat and dictator in the history of Latin America, everything matches. Getting rid of that, targeting media outlets, prosecuting journalists, spying. I don't know if you heard, but I can share this with you. In November 2021, I got an email from Apple saying that my phone had been compromised. I said, 30 other journalists got this email, and we realized that we had been targeted with Pegasus. I don't know if you know Pegasus, but it's the most invasive spyware at the moment, only sold to governments. I don't think any other government, apart from the Salvadoran one, would want to have access to my phone. And this, Pegasus is really expensive. El Salvador is quite a poor country. I don't think a president that is democratic would use precious resources to target and spy journalists. I believe that's part of the autocrat's playbook. So when you put those things together, what you are seeing is the birth of the new dictator and the new brand of dictator. Not one dressed in like olive green and military suit. One that has a backwards cap, one that tweets, one that buys Bitcoin. But at the same time, one that is targeting the opposition and critical minds. That is where El Salvador is going. If he won an election, yes, but he's also doing all of these things.
Next question.
You both have spent a great deal of time debating whether Bukele's policies are good for El Salvador, but the resolution is about whether it'd be a good model for other countries. So I'm curious how these policies might be more or less effective in other countries in Latin America.
Peter?
I mean, I think it's probably a bit simplistic, but I do think that arresting and imprisoning murderous gangs that are terrorizing your population is a good policy, and I support that policy.
Comment?
I believe it's far more complicated than that. It's far more nuanced than that. That's why I try to...
It wasn't for the people who get murdered down there.
Okay, I'm going to try to be more nuanced and serious than that. I try to give you 4 points as to why it wouldn't be applicable. I'm going to go back on those points. 4, because it's an instrument of fear, and I don't believe governments want... Like, I don't believe the citizens of Latin America and different countries, they want fear. I believe they want not only the lack of violence, but also the presence of safety and freedom, including the freedom to criticize their government, so that I don't think it's applicable to other countries. But I also... I'm going to go back to point number one because I believe that's where my answer lies. It is not applicable, but because if you want to do what Bukele has done in terms of security, you also have to do what Bukele has done in terms of the rule of law at institutions in El Salvador. You could not have a regime, an exception regime or a state of emergency in Colombia if the courts are still independent because they will bring it down. You cannot have... a state of emergency in a complex, difficult country like Brazil or a difficult country like I don't know, Mexico or any others where there are like various political voices, various political aspirations. So I don't think it's possible without removing all of those checks and restraints on power. So yeah, that's my simple answer. It's impossible. Because also, El Salvador is a tiny country. It's like you can cross the entire country in 4.5 hours. 6 million people, it's fairly easy to govern. You could never do this. You could never stage such a big power grab and then do what Bukele is doing in a country that like Colombia or like Panama or I don't know, like bigger countries. So no, I don't think it's possible.
Next question.
When does his term end, and do you expect a peaceful transfer of power for both of you?
Peaceful transfer of power. Why don't you take it, Peter?
I mean, at least to my knowledge of what I've read, that Bukele has talked about stepping away and allowing a different leader to assume the presidency. I haven't read anything or heard anything to make me think that that will not be the case, that there will be a peaceful transfer of power.
You know, Bukele doesn't talk to the local press. Bukele only talks to... Oh, he doesn't. He doesn't talk to the press. He sends some of his people to talk to different... media outlets from around the world, known to independent media outlets in El Salvador. But he does talk to some influencers and content creators. And there's this Mexican guy whose name or stage name is Luisito Comunica. And he came to El Salvador. He's widely famous. Like in Latin America, a lot of people know him. I teach a class, and all my 20-year-old students are big fans of him. So they had a meeting. This is 2019, 2020. And in this like meeting slash interview they had, Nayib Bukele said, because one of them asked him, like, so you're young, you're 39 or something at the time, what will you do afterwards? Because, like, you know, presidents are usually, like, much older, and that's, like, their retirement. And Bukele said, I don't know, man, it's weird. Like, I'll be out of a job when I'm 42 because I can no longer run for re-election. I mean, I can be re-elected 80 times, I'm quoting. I can be re-elected 80 times, but not consecutively. So Bukele himself said that. Bukele recognized that the Salvadoran law did not allow for him to run again consecutively. But now it is, but he removed the justices and now he's back in power. So I wouldn't take his word too seriously. The Bitcoin community in El Salvador had a golf tournament recently. I don't know if it's called tournament, I don't play golf, but they had a golf thing recently, and the main organizer was wearing a Bukele 2029 cap. That would be his third election run now. Obviously, like, it's not the president himself doing it, but according to our constitution, there should be consequences if you solely promote the idea of free election. So I do not believe in peaceful transfer of power, because also we are not talking about this, but there are huge, widely and well-reported accusations of corruption, and the stakes are really high at the moment in El Salvador. So I believe the people now in power will do everything they can to either stay keeping Mr. Bukele himself or stay keeping someone else that's very close and will be effectively a puppet.
Next question.
Thank you. My question is for Peter. So you said twice during your remarks that you don't think Bukele's policies are perfect and you think that it's really important for them to have scrutiny. But as Ricardo has pointed out, and many analysts and journalists working in El Salvador have pointed out, that the only reason Bukele has so effectively been able to execute this crackdown on the gangs is because his government has systematically dismantled any meaningful form in which they can be scrutinized. So my question is, why or how can you argue that that would be a sensible and not a dangerous policy in a region where so many presidents with unchecked power have done such horrendous things and committed such horrendous human rights abuses?
Peter.
Well, I think that I don't know. It's hard for me to, you know, conceptualize. Mm-hmm. Sorry, let me reconstitute what I'm saying. I think that there is no evidence that this has turned into, if you listen to what Ricardo is saying, he's making it seem like it's already turned into some authoritative dictatorship where there's no pushback and there's no freedom of speech and people aren't allowed to say their piece and push back. I mean, there's protests there, there are people, there's also an international community often propped up by the State Department that seems very anathema to his policies and are very keen to oppose them. So there's NGOs and journalists and people all over the world that can investigate that and find if there are those abuses happening. But again, all I can go on is right now, and I don't see those happening.
Going.
Oh, we have reported on them. I'm happy to share all that information with you. Okay, so I can show you the Apple email where it says that I've been targeted, and I can show you the report by three different organizations that say I have Pegasus. Would you say that's a normal thing? That a journalist is being spied on by his government. Would you say that's a?
Do you consider yourself a journalist?
Yes.
Isn't it true that most of your organization's funding comes through the National Endowment for Democracy?
No, I'm. What does that have to do with journalism? They do not. We have received funds from.
Well, it's a funding apparatus of the State Department and de facto the CIA that implements policies in South America.
They have no access to my editorial meetings. We are free to report whatever we want to report in a way that's truthful, but we can choose we're also free to report things that are not truthful, then we wouldn't have the readers or any sort of reputation. But I believe you're trying to make this like a sort of like boogeyman of like, I'm glad you didn't say Soros because that would have been too easy. But
you were funded by the Open Society as
nope,
well, right?
Never in my life. Didn't work, man. But what I'm trying to say is there have been, does the fact that we have been funded by NED mean that it's okay to spy us with Pegasus? Because the question was, if you think that's okay. And I'm just giving you one anecdotal example of one journalist who was targeted, but I can give you many more. There are protests, but there are a lot of unmarked cars taking pictures of people in protest. Recently, we're running out of time, but a group of people from this organization called MOVIR, which is Movimiento de las Víctimas del Régimen, the victims of the regime of exception, they were protesting and demanding justice for their kids. And on the way to the bus or whatever, like to home, they were rounded up by the police and they started taking pictures to their documents. Now, I don't know, like you can protest in the US, but I don't know if a police officer will come and ask for your ID and take a picture of it. What for? This is happening in El Salvador, and the journalists who saw that and started, like, they approached it with their cameras to try to capture this. The police said, we can't arrest you if you keep doing this. How do I know this? Because there is a lot of evidence. People are taking pictures of protesters. People are, like, the government is spying on journalists. It has threatened. I mean, a lot of journalists have had to leave the country. A lot of people cannot go back to El Salvador now. I don't believe that, like, I don't believe the fact that a media outlet is funded by NED makes this all okay.
The Q&A will have to stop. And whatever you want to say, Peter, work it into your summation. We move to the summary portion of the evening. You can take the podium or do it from the chair. 5 minutes of summary. Take it away, Peter.
I guess the only reason I brought that up is the NED has been involved with NGOs of organizations trying to overthrow countries from Haiti to Egypt and the Arab Spring. So, you know, just calling it like, we're just pure journalism out here. I don't know, maybe. I would just want to finish with, I mean, I think there's a lot of fair concern that people have expressed of, you know, destruction of these institutions and the possibility of El Salvador falling into authoritarian control and an awful dictatorship. And, you know, if that happens, that would be really terrible, and I really hope that happens. Again, all I can go on as a journalist is what I experienced down there. And what I experienced was a beautiful country with beautiful people that were excited about the future, that were empowered to live their lives in a free way. I mean, I was walking around the central square on a Sunday night, and, you know, it was filled with children eating ice cream and playing, and there was Disney characters. I guess they're a little more cool than the Times Square ones. But the point was that it was beautiful, and, I mean, at least from what people had told me, that 2 years ago this would be completely impossible because there might be bullets flying, there might be extortion, there might be kidnapping. So all I can go on is what I saw with my own eyes, not what might happen in 10 years or what, you know, what could happen. Is a country on the uptick, a country that is promoting freedom, that cares about free enterprise, crypto, and most importantly, the rule of law, which I really truly believe that a society cannot be a free society if you do not have the rule of law. If its citizens are terrified and under threat, you can say all the right things, you can have all these things written down, it is not a free society. So in my opinion, seeing the limited time that I was down there, what Bukele has brought to El Salvador is freedom.
Ricardo, 5 minutes.
Yeah, you know, Gene, I used to work with Cuban opposition a couple of years ago, many years ago, with a group of rappers and everything. And it had been 10 years since I had been sort of hinted at being a CIA operative, so thank you for that. And I'm not overthrowing any governments. I live a peaceful life in Southeast London now, where no one's spying on me. And I'm also very happy that you enjoyed your week in El Salvador. El Salvador has had a long history of authoritarian rule. We have had all sorts of dictators. We had military in power and everything. And a lot of those things that were happening back then are happening now. The fact that people don't feel free to say what they think, the fact that journalists can be spied on, the fact that people can be rounded up and sent to a prison cell because they oppose mining projects. There are a lot of environmental activists in prison in El Salvador right now. Those things do not happen in a democratic society. Those things do not happen when someone brings freedom to the country. Those things happen when someone brings a power plan and a very strict script on how to retain power and never give it. It seems to me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems to me that you don't have a problem with an aspiring autocracy as long as it coincides with some of the things you like crypto and some other policies. But if you take all those things away, El Salvador's case looks a lot like Nicaragua's case, looks a lot like Venezuela's case, just with a freedom discourse attached to it. Now, how long do I have for this?
We have about another 3 minutes.
Okay. I don't know if you've read Kurt Vonnegut, Breakfast of Champions, but Kurt Vonnegut has a story of this bird in a golden cage, and the bird is granted 3 wishes. The first wish is to open the cage. The second wish is to open the window. And the third wish is to go back into the cage. And I can say, I teach a political systems class to graphic design students who've never had any interaction with politics. And the way I start my class is by asking them why people go back with their exes. And we talk about, and that's the main point of the class is, countries go back to authoritarian governments the same reason people go back with their toxic exes. And it's because we are scarred by our traumas, and we may be led to believe that manipulation, gaslighting, lies, control, and excessive vigilance over your life means freedom, but it does not. I refuse to believe that third world countries deserve third world solutions, like Matt Gaetz said. Matt Gaetz, obviously a very good friend of Nayib Bukele. They like taking pictures together. I refuse to believe that. I refuse to believe that Salvadorans deserve, hopefully, a benevolent ruler that may end up becoming a dictator. I do believe that Salvadorans need freedom, but I do believe freedom comes from the rule of law, and that we agree. But the rule of law does not mean following the whims of one person and his family that effectively works like a little board. It comes from respecting the will of the majority without stepping on the rights of the minority. And I don't remember who the author is that said that the smallest minority is the individual. So I believe that we should look beyond what's immediately presented to us. Bastiat said, like, we just focus not only on what is seen, but also on what is not seen. And what is not seen in El Salvador and what is not presented is that this is the quickest way to achieve a new dictatorship, one that will be suffered by millions and will be cheered on by a few Bitcoin bros.
Okay. Jane, please open the voting for the final vote. Again, yes, no, or undecided. President Nayib Bukele's crime-fighting policies in El Salvador provide a model for reducing violence in other Latin American countries, and the winner of this debate, according to Oxford-style rules, who moves the vote in his favor, will win the Tootsie Roll of the SOHO Forum. While you're voting, let me make a couple of announcements. We do have a hard exit here at 8:30. Gives us about 25 minutes to have a bit of a party, to interact with our debaters, and to partake of the food, the sandwiches. You can doggy bag a couple of them. We seem to have a great many. They're all delicious. And, of course, order a drink at the bar. So we unfortunately are having an abbreviated after party. We usually like to have them longer, but let's make the most of the party time that we do have. To make a couple of announcements then about SOHO Forums to come, we do, of course, 12 SOHO Forum debates a year, an average of one a month. Strangely, because of the semester structure at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, we're going to have a debate this coming Saturday afternoon in Hanover at Dartmouth. And I asked the Dartmouth hosts for 25 free tickets for any SOHO Forum members. And my assistant informed me that we were oversubscribed. And I told him, please send me the emails so that those people as well can get free tickets to go to Hanover, New Hampshire. I was surprised that there was such interest. Most of it, of course, will be Hanover, New Hampshire, Dartmouth students, and, of course, Dartmouth professors. The debate will be Scott Horton versus Eli Lake, and the resolution will read, "The United States started the new Cold War with Russia and provoked Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That will be defended by Scott Horton, and it's going to be quite a show. I got a call, and a message this morning from Dartmouth professors who wanted the resolution modified. This led to some negotiations, and we're now going to give them an hour of Q&A because that's the demand that the Dartmouth professors want to line up and challenge the resolution. So it will be an extraordinary exchange at Dartmouth College. And again, it's not too late for you to go if you're so inclined. I, of course, will be driving up on Friday and moderating. It's Sunday the 2nd. I will be driving up on Saturday the 1st, and it will be a 3 o'clock matinee on Sunday the 2nd. I thought we'd make it early enough in the semester before midterms and before finals. Dartmouth does, surprisingly, because we've had a lot of trouble penetrating universities, it surprisingly does have an active debate society. In fact, this debate was originally going to be held at a university in Boston, but that Boston University vetoed it at the last minute because some higher-ups thought it was too controversial. What we've debated this evening was too controversial for a university in Boston, a sorry reflection on the level of higher education in the Boston area, as I'm sure you'd agree. But Dartmouth is allowing this incendiary debate, and I now see that we're going to have the results of this particular debate. Thank you, Jane. I'm going to take a look at it. The proposition, of course, was President Nayib Bukele's crime-fighting policies in El Salvador provide a model for reducing violence in other Latin American countries. Well, the yes votes lost a little, lost 3 points. The no votes gained 28 points. So the Tootsie Roll goes to the negative. Congratulations, and congratulations to you both. Again, plenty of opportunity to talk to our debaters, plenty of opportunity to have the sandwiches and the drinks. Please stick around. I'd love to talk to you all.